It's time to talk about the outdoors in South Alabama. Hunting, fishing, and getting outside along the Great Gulf Coast. It's time to take it outside with FM Talk 106.5 Outdoors. With reports, stories, how-to information, and Dr. Bill's Marine Forecast. Here's Sean Sullivan and Mike Ward.
All right, so Mike is on assignment this week. That's what we call it when he's, you know, probably speckled trout fishing first thing this morning. It's okay, Mike. It's okay. I can handle this. He'll be back with us next week. Welcome to FM Talk 106.5 Outdoors. Glad to have you here on this Saturday morning. Coming up on today's show, my buddy Keith Galdon with the Wildlife and Freshwater Fisheries Division. Talk some gators and bears on today's show. Plus, coming up after the break, we'll check in with Blake Michaleski of the Mobile Big Game Fishing Club. Talk about some of the results from the Emerald Coast Billfish Classic and also some live betting, live bait catching techniques to get those big baits to catch those big fish. So we'll do that here in just a little bit. Also, a reminder, as red snapper season is open now, it's also open during the week. Mind you, right, to this point, we've had Friday, Saturday, Sundays of our 47-day season. Well, this is that week in the middle that we had talked about going into it. So while we're open right now, obviously, because it's the weekend, as of Monday, we're still open, and we'll be open through this coming Sunday. So a week from tomorrow, it's when it closes back down, and then it goes back to the normal cycle. So right now, you can be snapper fishing. No issue there, all right? So get out and enjoy it. All right, coming right back, we'll talk some offshore. Blake Michaleski, Mobile Big Game Fishing Club, and some really big blue marlin coming in last weekend, and how they caught the one of them, the winning one, what they caught it on, or at least what the rumor is they caught it on. We'll get to that next. Y'all stay close. Time for the FM Talk 106.5 Offshore Fishing Report, brought to you by HMS Marine Electronics. For all your fishing technology by major brands like Garmin, you'll be supporting a local online retailer that offers all the price savings and perks of the big box stores and more. In the industry since 2004, in the business since 2013, Garmin and NEMA certified. Visit HMSMarineElectronics.com or go to Facebook, HMS Marine Electronics, featuring Garmin Ultra High Definition Scanning Sonar with stunningly clear images, side view, and clear view clarity. That means the fish have nowhere to hide. And it is time to talk about the world of offshore fishing with our buddy Blake Michaleski from the Mobile Big Game Fishing Club. And lots to talk about here with a pretty big tournament in the rearview mirror. Hey, Blake.
Hey, Sean. Yeah, that's right. Coming off a week from the big Emerald Coast Blue Marlin Classic over there in Sandest, and it was one for the record books in a couple of ways. It was a tournament record as far as number of boats and the total money involved, 91 boats, $2.04 million at hand.
Wow. You know, it's interesting, the world of big game fishing, because people get hung up in, you know, we'll be talking during the week in sports and say, you know, this tournament pays this, or, you know, if they win this match, this golfer wins this. But we seem to forget that we've got some pretty big money sporting events in our area when it comes to fishing.
Absolutely, Sean. And, of course, it depends on how much you enter the optionals, as we'll say.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Yeah, that's a discussion for another day. But this Emerald Coast Blue Marlin Classic, how does it draw from where? Is it just in the Destin area? Or I mean,
it's mostly the Gulf Coast. You have boats all the way from Texas competing. And I'm not sure about up the East Coast, but every now and then a East Coaster will sneak around into Florida and come fish our tournaments. We'd like to see more of them, obviously. There's some really nice boats and some really nice operations going on up there.
Absolutely. Let's talk results from that tournament too.
Yeah, I mean the big fish continue, the big blue marlin with third place. You never know, caught out at the Independence Hub a 640, which is a pretty, you know, really nice fish that could win any tournament around here. And then the owner's from Baton Rouge, but then the boat is based in Pensacola, the Real Fire, with Captain Chris Blanchett. They checked in with a 665.2.
Wow.
But the big story was the kids. There was a team of 18-year-olds. They're all, you know, just finished their senior year in high school, and they're off to college in the fall. And they all pitched in and paid the $6,000 entry fee, and aboard the Can't Deny It, these guys weighed in a 699.2, which was well over 700 when it was caught.
Wow. Well, I mean, I'm saying wow on a couple things. Number one, the size of that blue marlin. But number two, you know, for those kids to be organized enough at that age to do that. And, gosh, you got to mow a lot of lawns to get the entry fee there.
Yeah, that's right. These kids have been fishing together for a long time. Will Beard was the angler, and Bo Keogh, captain, who's been around the Orange Beach area for a while. Todd Terrison was the mate, and their friends, Richie Prince Jr., Mac Waller, P. Van Lingren, and Todd's dad, Doug, went out on I believe it was on their uncle's boat, 120 nautical miles due south of Best, and caught it on a lure.
Wait. We just got done with a big discussion of you know, these big marlin coming in this year, and you and I got in this big discussion of live baiting these marlin. And it was a lure? Was it a blue and white islander?
It's been alleged as much.
Uh-huh.
It could have been. I've also heard a chugger. We probably will never know the true answer, but I know from fact it was a lure. I didn't see the lure. It kind of looked like a blue and pink from some pictures, so...
So listen, I mean, while yes, the majority of these big marlin are caught on live baits, it's still worth, if you're going from place to place, dragging a plastic can pay off.
Absolutely. If you're out in open water and you're needing to cover water and find a fish, you know, if you roll up to an oil rig, you're pretty confident that, you know, it's a good spot to check for a fish. But, and that's where live baiting works, because you can't cover a lot of ground live baiting, but with lures you certainly can.
And that, what a story, though. And so the crew gets together, they catch it, they bring it in. Obviously, that wins handily. That's not even like down to the, you know, tenths of a pound. That baby just wins.
Right. And they came away with about $131,000 for it. They were just entered into the tournament. They weren't in any of the cash, in any of the optionals. And there were some checks this weekend over $250,000, a few of them.
Wow.
But, you know, from the guys who got in on the big, you know, Breathe Easy, I know came away with a nice check. And some of your guys who were do this, you know, each time. Catch and release was pretty hot. The Born to Run, they caught four or released four. And then the You Never Know also released two on top of the one they weighed. And then Gulf Favorite Done Deal also came in with two. So they wrapped up third place in catch and release. What Dundee really pulled off was a 190-pound tuna for first place. Really
wow.
Nice one.
Wow.
And then, yeah, that's a good one. And then with angler Katie Goslin, who caught that. And then the Al Dente and Donnie D had a tight one for second and third, 168.6, 168.4. So it does get real close sometimes, and that can make a big difference depending on how you're entered in the optionals.
Hey, and talking about that, you have so much experience not only with fishing out there, but with the tackle side of it. What does somebody do? Let's talk about the people that may not have the size fish bond. You know, we start talking about, obviously, marlin, one thing, but when tuna start getting over 120, 125 pounds, it takes a whole lot of cooler for that fish. I mean, what are people doing?
Right.
If they're on it, you know, if I'm on a center console boat or whatever, you just, I guess, make sure to have a hatch big enough, or are people using those bags for them, or what are they doing?
The big bags are very popular, even for the marlin, which they treat them more like a blanket. You know, they roll them up in it with bags of ice and wet towels and anything to keep that fish from losing weight on the way in. It's including stuff in, you know, gloves and in the gaff wounds, and just to keep them from bleeding out, because sometimes that point, you know, that you see right here, 0.2 pounds made the difference. That could have been 0.2 pounds worth of blood, or you knock enough slime off of one of them mishandling it up the dock, you can do the same thing.
Wow, it's that narrow. But that's so it continues. I mean, you started off with us back in May talking about big marlin and big tuna, and here we are still pushing July and talking about the same thing.
Right, and we've been hearing that the tuna bite overall has been pretty slow. This goes to show what you can do when you're out there to catch one fish. You know,
yeah.
It's a lot different than going out and trying to catch plenty of them for the box.
Well, okay, but if we are going to target plenty of them for the box, and also talking about, you know, we talked live bait, even though they caught that big one on a lure. Let's talk about consistency, and that is using those big live baits for marlin. Also, you know, as you, whether you're chunking or doing something else, you've got to get meat on the boat to go tuna fishing. So it will change. Usually we're talking about how to catch those fish, those tuna, those marlin, those swordfish. Can we switch gears here and talk about how to catch that bait that we're going to need?
Absolutely. It's super critical, and there's a there's some guys who have made, you know, and of course I'm from Louisiana, so you got, we'll call it making bait.
Yeah,
you know? So you got to go
like
out
y'all
and make bait.
Groceries, make bait. Yes,
make groceries and make bait.
Yes,
that's right. Make bait to make groceries. So, you know, so you're talking, say we want to go tuna fishing and you want some hardtails. You know, commonly a sabiki rigs are a nice way to catch the small ones, which I'm sure you, as well as most of these guys, know. Those can be one of the worst things on this planet to deal with is a sabiki rig. You know, it ends up in everybody and on everything.
That'd be correct.
They make specialized rods for those where it reels up inside, which makes it real handy, quick to deploy, quick to stow, and easy to manage.
You know, I have made the mistake of, I said, well, I got a piece of foam from one of those pool noodles, a small pool noodle, and said, okay, yeah. I'm going to wrap my sabiki rigs in this, and the hooks, see, they'll stay in the foam, and then I'll put them in the tackle box. Blake, if I could tell you the hours I spent disassembling all that, it I don't know how all the sabikis came loose at one time and wrapped in everything else I had and themselves. So that rod is that'd be a lifesaver for me.
Yeah, that, or you buy the about the cheapest sabikis you can find, and they're basically one use, you know. And for $2 to $3 each, it's sometimes worth just to cut it off and throw it in the trash bag. Please, you know, don't throw it overboard, but it's not worth aggravation in your time. And, you know, and it's not worth, if you get one tangled up, it's often quicker to throw on a new one versus untangle it so you can catch that bait before it gets too spooked or whatever.
Yeah, and how's that been? Because it's funny, it's... and I don't know your experience, but mine is there are hardtails everywhere until you got to get some hardtails for bait. And then all of a sudden, they're harder to find.
Yeah, that's right. You just, some of the guys that are consistent actually have bait fads placed out near the beach or, you know, but the farewell buoys and the weather buoys tend to be, you know, a good place to start as well as the near shore oil rigs. Now, you can find big schools of them roaming around if you're lucky, and typically they'll, you know, they're not too hard to catch, but they can be a little picky sometimes.
Well, once you find them, I agree. What I'm saying is just like not even thinking about those places, but certain capped oil rigs and places we used to go to catch bait, you know, if we're out there not trying to get them, I mean, there's acres of them around the cap, and then the day we have to have them for a tournament, we're like, where'd they go?
Well, and that's why a lot of guys will spend a significant amount of time ahead of, say, a tournament or a big trip to just go bait fishing, you often the day before. And depending on where your boat stops, if that boat that stays in the water, obviously this helps. And so you can get the idea of rested and recovered baits. You go out and catch all these baits, you bring them in, and by that evening, if you're going to be dead, and you'd be surprised by next morning, not many have. The ones who are going to die, they die off. And others, you can actually let them, you know, recover, and they get hardier. So then when you go back out and you put them on a hook, they actually last longer. That's a big South Florida live bait sail fishing tactic. These guys will keep baits for a week and sit there and feed them to where they don't even run from you anymore. You know, so you're not having to chase them down
wait,
live well.
Wait,
you open the
wait.
Live well and they come up thinking they're about to get fed.
Wait, Blake. You know, we've known each other a long time, mate. You're telling me that the folks are keeping the live baits long enough to have them trained up to eat from their, you know.
Apparently it doesn't take long with goggle eyes and cigar minnows.
I'll be darned.
Yeah.
Hey,
and when that live well lid opens, they're getting the treat.
Love it.
Until they get the net.
Right, right. They don't realize what's next. But you mentioned like cigar minnows and goggle eyes, too. You know, they're catching hardtails. What about catching those other live baits?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, you know, there's times where a cast net will work best for your mullet or things like that. But one of my favorite ways to catch, like, say, we want big hardtails. I throw a tan. You remember the old spec rigs, right?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Unequal length. Those work pretty good, but a little better trick on that is to get two pompano rigs, which are a little heavier, and a rig them the same way. And then you can get those big hardtails two at a time. And on that, I prefer a fairly soft action spinning rod. Even fiberglass would be great because it's nice and soft, and you don't pull your baits off as easy. They don't rip free because they fight really hard, but you're trying to get them to the boat quick. So you got to give them a shock absorber to kind of eat up those shakes, and so they don't rip free.
That's a good point. A good tip, and I make this admission.
And,
although
and I go with monofilament on this too. I fish
you don't
a lot
braid.
Of braid.
You don't braid for your bait rods.
I'm sorry, say it.
You don't run braid on your bait rods.
On some, it depends, but a lot of like anything, like especially my sabiki rods, are all monofilament, and typically more hardtail ones too.
By the way, just joining us, talking to Blake Michaleski with the Big Game Fish, Mobile Big Game Fishing Club. And yeah, for once, we're not talking about the fish we're usually going after. We're talking about the fish we need to go after those fish. And a little admission to everybody here. For me, I don't mind catching for the 5 or 10 minutes of catching bait. Hardtails are pretty fun to catch, but that's a whole other show.
Oh, absolutely, especially the bigger ones.
Yeah,
they're a sport in themselves.
Well, and I'm thinking about them and their body shape and how they fight, which brings me to some of the bigger baits out there. Now we're talking, you know, what you'd be rigging for marlin and things like blackfin tuna or bonita.
Right, and we touched on a good bit of that, I believe, 2 weeks ago mm-hmm. on talking about jigging for blackfins and how to take care of them. And so if we're specifically talking for bait, we've got the idea of if you're catching blackfins for live bait or say skipjack tunas or bonitas, you don't have a lot of time with them, and you have to be easy with them. And what I mean is you need to get them to the boat quickly, and say if you're running a vertical, if you're jigging for them, take one hook off. Use just a single hook. I even cramp my barb down a little bit.
Huh.
You just got to stay tight so that when you get him on board, you can get him unhooked and in a tuna tube as quick as possible.
Okay,
and that
that's
way
a good tip.
He's not as stressed for when it comes time to bridle him on a circle hook for a live bait.
Okay, and so that's going to – I mean, you're going to do the same thing whether you're – you're after, like you said, skipjack tuna, bonita, or blackfin.
Yeah, and bonitas are a bit hardier than the blackfins, but all these fish need constant water flow over their gills. They never stop swimming, so that's why they go. You can't put them in a live well. You have to put them into what's called tuna tube, where its feet they're vertically, so they're a little disoriented. It's black on the inside, but there's constant water flow being pushed across them. So the best way, and really the only way, to keep a tuna or any kind of fish in the mackerel family alive.
All right, let's talk tournaments now that we've, like y'all say, in Louisiana made bait here. Let's talk about what's up next with the Mobile Big Game Fishing Club.
Well, this weekend is our makeup for the Memorial Day weekend, which we're recording on Wednesday, so our captain's meeting is tonight. The boats will leave on Thursday, and then they'll go out and fish. They can weigh in Friday at Pensacola or both locations, either the Mobile Big Game Fishing Club or the Pensacola Yacht Club. On Saturday, and so that's our makeup for the Memorial Day. It's going to be double club cut points, which is our interclub competition. Now, and then the following weekend, the weekend after the July 4th, is our junior angler tournament, which I'm really looking forward to. You know, something for the kids, and it's just a per angler sign up, not per boat. So you can take the kids down to the seawall and just fish off there. You know, for there's a variety of easy to access species for the kids, pinfish, croaker, et cetera, but also all the offshore species.
All right. So if people want more information on this, or obviously, like we've said in the past, if people are just starting to dabble in blue water, some offshore fishing, you don't have to, I mean, people don't need the idea that, oh, I got to be some seasoned offshore angler to become part of this this group. This is a great way to learn, right? To just be a member.
Yeah, to meet like-minded people and to pick up on and, get invited to go or, offering to share expenses and just go and learn from each other. It's a great way to learn about the sport. And your entry, I mean, it's worth the money just if you come and eat at the tournaments and come to our annual membership meetings.
So all right.
You can find out more at mbgfc.org or on Facebook at facebook.com/thembgfc.
All right, great stuff, Blake. Get after it, and we'll talk again next week when it'll be like hotter than a firecracker or something like that.
Have some results from our turn from this makeup tournament.
Yeah, I can't wait. I mean, with the size of blue marlin that have been coming in, man, I'm expecting something big.
Well, and just remember that Alabama grander is still out there. That fish is out there, so. It's we all fish the same waters, and the 1,000-pound fish is out there, so it's any time now.
Man, I can't wait for that day to be talking about it. Blake, thanks for your time.
All right, thank you, Sean.
All right, Blake Michaleski from the Mobile Big Game Fishing Club on with us for the FM Talk 106.5 Offshore Fishing Report, brought to you by HMS Marine Electronics for all your fishing technology by major brands like Garmin. You'll be supporting a local online retailer that offers all the price savings and perks of the big box stores and more. In the industry since 04, in the business since 13, Garmin and EBOS certified. Visit HMSMarineElectronics.com or on Facebook, HMS Marine Electronics, featuring Garmin ultra high definition scanning sonar with stunningly clear images. Side view and clear view clarity means the fish have nowhere to hide. All right, welcome back. FM Talk 106.5 Outdoors. Glad to have you here on this Saturday. Brought to you in part by Buffalo Rock. Diet Mountain Dew and the old-fashioned fully leaded Mountain Dew. Big thank you to Joey Peterson and the gang. And we roll on through the show. A lot to talk about. And we went from out in the blue water, right, and talking about some of those big weights coming in the Emerald Coast Classic Marlin Tournament, Blue Marlin Tournament from last weekend. Upcoming tournament for the Mobile Big Game Fishing Club tournament coming up this weekend. Their makeup from the Memorial Day tournament and then the youth tournament next week. And, of course, Snapper, part of that discussion. But we'll take you even further. What did we say last week when we were talking about freshwater fishing? We had offshore, inshore, and really inshore. And really, really inshore in the Mobile Tensaw Delta, one of the many places we'll be able to hunt alligators in August. If you're lucky enough to find out early next month, if you were drawn, let's talk more about that with Wildlife Section Chief at the Department of Wildlife and Freshwater Fisheries, and my friend Keith Galdon. Hey, Keith.
Good morning, Sean. How are you this morning?
Good. And happy summertime to you. I'll say this. Well, I know you you want to get back down and chase some saltwater fish. I saw some pictures the other day where you're catching spotted bass, and that is out of the bass species. I've never caught a smallmouth, but out of the ones I've caught in my life, the spots are my favorite, man. I love those things.
Yeah, they're a spunky fish. I guess he's right below the smallmouth in the spunkiness category. But, yeah, we're catching them on the main river, the Coosa River. They're big pods of shad, and those spotted bass were just crunching those shad and catching them on top water. It was just to be out there and see all that activity was cool in itself, but catching one's even better. But, yeah, I guess you can still catch spots down there, but I guess up the Alabama River on all the rock outcroppings that the Corps created.
Right,
yeah. You'll catch some, but not typically down that way.
Right, not as many as up in your – just – chunky. Well, I don't want to say they're overweight because they're the right way, but they're chunky and they are spunky as well. All right, I want to talk a couple of critter things with you here from the wildlife perspective and alligator season as we talk way inshore and the alligator hunt coming up in August. Tell folks parameter-wise, I know we opened up a couple weeks ago with the lottery, and when does that close down? Like, when do they have to be in by?
Yeah, we opened that random selection process June 5th, I believe, and it stays open till July 11th is when we close that. So people have still an ample opportunity of time to put in for that. We have the same number of permits that we had last year for the four different zones down the Delta. We still have 120 tags available, so people have a pretty good opportunity. And down that way, if somebody wanted to harvest alligator in that zone and they got selected for that zone, it's pretty easy. It's the ones that hold out and hold out and hold out for a big one. They come home empty-handed sometimes.
Yeah, I want to talk a little bit about the biology of that, and I wonder about the numbers, because what you're saying is absolutely true, right? People get drawn for it. They go, okay, I got my gator tag. I'm going after big boy. And in the gator world, big boys are usually, those are bulls. Those are males, right?
That's correct.
Now,
typically the females are smaller.
All right, so if we're, I don't know what the percentages are, but if we're targeting more males than females, are we, and I don't know if it's the purpose of this, was the purpose ever to keep this population in check, or was it just using a renewable resource? I mean, what was the directive here?
Yeah, you know, we get a lot of nuisance complaints on alligators as their range continues to expand, and particularly that we have these past years, we've had warmer years, so we're having alligator calls from up around Huntsville now in the Tennessee River, which was sort of not heard of a few years back, but it's obviously that their range is spreading. So we've incorporated this season to try to be able to target some of these nuisance individuals instead of our trappers going out and harvesting these animals. We can at least have a recreational opportunity to allow our hunters to go out and harvest these animals to help us not only control the nuisance part of the gator's biology, but also to provide a recreational opportunity for a renewable, sustainable resource that we have in our alligator population.
Yeah, and that's what's cool. Instead of having, and you know, I know there'll be some cases where you still have to bring the folks in with the state to do this, but in other cases, it is a win-win because you get rid of that nuisance gator, and then you have somebody, let's say somebody from North Alabama or somewhere else gets drawn for down here. They come down, get hotels and buy, you know, great seafood meals and buy gas and all that. So yeah, it's good for the economy.
Sure it is. You know, all hunting is good for the economy in that standpoint. And, you know, any of the four areas that we hunt, we'll do a survey prior to the season this year just to make sure that our populations are at the levels that we feel comfortable with. And that's what we sort of base our harvest off of. And presently, from our our data from our surveys, we have a stable, if not growing, population in our alligator populations in the state. So our harvest numbers are very, very conservative harvest numbers so that we don't negatively impact any of the populations, but it does provide that opportunity to have a select few of folks to participate in this program.
Well, I mean, that's what I'm thinking about the population. It's interesting, and from a biologist's perspective like that, how, I mean, if we are not, I don't want to say overly, like, giving it a negative connotation, but it seems like if we are targeting those big gators, and lots of folks are, you know, at least for the first couple of nights or the first weekend, are targeting the big gators, then we're targeting way more males than females, right? And, I mean, we didn't know anything about keeping a population in check. If you really wanted to, you chase the females. You kill those.
That's right. And I'm gonna let you follow. Their population is not as robust as we have in the other hunt areas, so we limit the harvest of females. We do that by incorporating a length limit on that area, so we sort of bypass the female population and just strictly target males in that population. But in the other areas that we hunt, that's not a problem. So we have more than enough gators, so we don't impose any length restriction whatsoever.
You know, things have changed with this since the state first instituted the hunt down here in southwest Alabama, and it used to be, I think, it was dictated by basically, I may not have the right term, navigable waters or public waters here, but we've now moved into people in certain zones being able to branch out beyond that.
Yes, the public and private waters in the majority of our zones, they're allowed to hunt if it's within the boundaries of those hunt zones. And you know, you mentioned about something about the alligators. It's really a remarkable conservation story because during the early 1900s, we had no alligators just about, and just through the commercial harvest, we just about decimated the populations, and through protection enacted by the Department of Conservation, Alabama is one of the first states to enact protection over the alligator. And through the years of protection, just regulatory protection, the alligators did the work themselves to repopulate the areas, and now to a point that we have to impose a couple of, you know, these controlled hunts to monitor the population to a level that we feel comfortable having in Alabama.
Yeah, I mean, I guess there's two parts of it there, the overall population, keeping it in check, but also, like you said, this gives another tool for the state to deal with nuisance gators. I had somebody sending me video actually this week to the radio station here where they had they were on Dog River, and they had one that was hanging around the house a whole bunch, and you know, I said, just wait, gator season's coming.
That's right. You know, we have more people than we used to, so these people are waterfront property, so they're buying more waterfront property. You know, these people are encroaching in alligator habitat, so when they move in these new areas and buy land on these waterways and alligator range, they're going to see alligators, and the unfortunate circumstance comes when somebody selectively feeds alligator. And that's one thing you do not want to do is feed a wild alligator, because they become habituated and associating humans as a production of a food source, and their small brain doesn't really depict if they're being fed, or, you know, they just associate people with food, so they're going to naturally come to you if one's been fed. So we do not advocate the public, you know, providing any kind of food source for alligators, because those create a circumstance where we have to have our nuisance trappers or our conservation officers or our biologists respond and remove the alligators, so we remove that danger to the people.
And just joining us, talking to Keith Goldman with the Wildlife Section of Wildlife and Freshwater Fisheries for the state of Alabama. And this is a bit of a transition here, because not the rest of it isn't the same, but the habituating an animal with feeding could also go into a discussion of black bears in Alabama, or black bears anywhere that become habituated to being fed.
Yeah, be it bird feeders or deer feeders that people have in their backyards, particularly those folks in the Mobile County, Washington County area where we have a sizable black bear population. It's amazing that the number of calls that we get that people complain about black bears around their house, and then we ask them if there's a food source, like, oh yeah, we have a deer feeder behind the house. So you have to remove the food source to remove the bears. So typically we recommend folks remove those food sources for those animals. Typically a couple of weeks, they figure out that that's not an area that has a potential food source, and they'll move along to a different area. But sometimes when you live in bear habitat, bear country, you can't do things that people that live outside those areas can do, like have bird feeders around your house or deer feeders, for that matter, your backyard, because you will attract bears because it's an easy food source for them to monopolize on.
Sure. I mean, if you had to do all the work it takes in the wild to get the calories you need to sustain yourself every day, or you could just knock that barrel over and go to chowing down and getting more carbs than you'd probably get in a week as a bear. I do the same thing.
Yeah, and they won't wait for the spinner to go off. They'll actually knock the feeder down. They'll destroy them to get to the goody inside of it.
That's for sure. So what about that? I mean, you spent a good time with us down here in Southwest Alabama. You know, I was very, very lucky to grow up even hunting in the 80s through the 80s on a piece of property in the Saraland, outside the Saraland city limits. And I grew up seeing bears. Of course, you know, still today, I'll talk to people, this will air, or I'll be talking during the show during the week, and I'll mention black bears in Mobile County, for example, Washington County, and people say, well, there's no bears down here. And I'll say, we have actually kind of been the somewhat of the Garden of Eden, the repository for the black bears in Alabama. But now the rest of the state seems to be getting in on the discussion. I can't open up one news site, Keith, and not see bear spotted by the Waffle House in, you know, northeast Alabama, or bears in east central Alabama, or bears in north Alabama.
Yeah, people ask us why they think that we're seeing more sightings of bears, and I think the answer is pretty simple, is that we have more bears now. You know?
Mathematical equation, yes.
Yeah, seriously, aside, in the Mobile County, Washington County area, we'll also get occurrences, not as much as we have a resident population in southeast Alabama, but we'll also get a bears from that Florida population coming up in Geneva County along the Panhandle counties. But also, we're starting to see a pretty good influx of bears in northeastern Alabama coming in from northwest Georgia. And that strain's not the Florida strain. It's actually the subspecies from the Appalachians, more like the mountain bears. And those bears actually excavate, you know, dens, and they actually semi-hibernate up that way. Down south where you're at, they typically just find a blow-down tree, and they'll just lower their heart rate a little bit, not really going to a so-called hibernation. They'll just slow down that time of the year. It's a different population, different bear. Visibly, they wouldn't be different compared to each other, but physiologically, they're probably a little bit different. But we're having more occurrences. We probably have a sighting for every county of the state now, and luckily, so far, we haven't had any problems this year. And if people see a bear, we would recommend they not call the media, but just call us instead and let us know about it, and just leave those bears alone. Let them go about their business. Don't chase them around or try to corner them, because that's the kind of situations where we have problems with them getting into residential neighborhoods and stuff like that. We try to just let them go off back in the woods on their own accord.
Yeah.
This time of year. Go ahead.
No, I was just saying, usually when it does make the news story or whatever, it is a neighborhood, right? It's not that somebody saw it out on some, open woodlands or in the back 40. It's usually, hey, they're down the street at the Jones's house.
Oh, yeah, they get the neighborhood, and they certainly attract attention. Everybody comes out of their houses, and what does a bear do when he's frightened? He'll climb a tree, and then everybody gets below the tree. Then the bear has no chance to escape whatsoever. And then that's when the media shows up and bright lights, and the bear's freaked out of the tree. So, and we just try to encourage everybody just to enjoy and feel fortunate they got to see the bear, and then let's let him mosey on his way back to the bear woods. Hopefully that works out. Most of the time that way, we don't have to intervention and sedate these animals and then move them outside their home range to relocate them. That's the last thing we try to do to these bears.
Well, that's a good point. Something people can, tank and see the bear and then give the bear space. Because I tell you right now, they will get out of your way, because when I see them, it's always in open woodlands. And let me tell you right now, they are on a motor scooter getting away from me when I've seen them. I mean, if you walk up in one and you kind of surprise each other to some degree, all I see is rump and back of feet when they're going.
Oh yeah, for the most part, they're probably more scared or as scared of you as you are of them.
And so they're getting okay. And it's interesting too. You mentioned a couple subspecies. I don't want to completely nerd out on this, Keith, but yes, I do.
Oh yeah, I am all over that.
Yeah, that down here, like northeast Alabama, I get it. Those are coming out of the Smokies. That subspecies. But here we have, I know Louisiana black bears, right? I've heard those defined, and Florida black bears. Is there what's here in Mobile and Washington County, and to some degree Baldwin and other counties here, is that a Louisiana black bear? Is that a Florida black bear? Is it an Alabama black bear? What is it?
It's a Louisiana black bear that lives in Louisiana. It's actually different subspecies over that way. we get some interchange from the collar bears that we've had and Mississippi's had. There's been some interchange from our population in Mobile and Washington counties with those in Mississippi, and I'm sure there's been exchange from, you know, Louisiana to Mississippi, and then we've gotten a little bit of exchange. We are concerned a little bit about the what's called a genetic bottleneck, where these bears have gone from a small population, and their population's got the size it has now, but they still have the genetic information of that small population, if that makes sense.
Sure, sure, which is going to be probably compounded, obviously, with more breeding opportunities, more bears. But what about this? I mean, it seems like, you know, you I'm sure y'all's phones ring in the spring and this time of year, more than others, because you have, you know, you have nature's plan there, right, with the young male bears going on walkabout, right? That carries new genetics to new areas.
It does. You know, when their mother, the sow, when she has an offspring that's a female, that female will typically hang just out the outside of that mother's territory. But the male, the young male, Mr. Junior, he's not welcome anywhere. He'll bump into different bears' ranges and get bumped everywhere. That's when we see those bears get in the town, get these easy food sources, because he's not a real, you know, real smart bear, being wise to woods ways. So he bumps into a male in his territory and gets his butt kicked. So he goes elsewhere to a sow's territory and she kicks his butt. So he's not welcome anywhere just about. So he's probably going to habitate in the most marginal, submarginal habitat. And they're typically the ones that get in trouble. They're easy to tell because when you look at a bear's face to tell the age, if his ears look huge, that's typically a sub-adult bear, like a teenager, just about a young bear that's just been dispersed out of his mother's territory. If the ears look real small, that means his head's real big, so that's typically an adult male. And this time of year, you will see a lot of the sub-adults ranging around doing the walkabout, as you say. But you'll also see those larger males, they'll increase their home range and size to look for girlfriends this time of year as well. They typically won't travel as far. They're typically not seen. They're not as visible as those sub-adult males either, so they typically don't get in the trouble that the younger fellows do.
I mean, is it somewhat analogous that a lot of people listening to the show will understand? It's a, you know, it's a spike or a four-point, a young buck compared to an older buck. You know, the spike in 4-point seems to be standing around every time you're coming and going in the woods, and you never see that big buck.
Yeah, same thing. They just don't have the woods wise experience that the older generation does. Now, you see a lot more spikes at 4 points than you do 8 to 10 points. Same thing. They're out there, but they're just not seen.
What about, and talking about this, you know, a black bear in Alabama, protected species, is there any kind of, is it a number to be achieved? Is there a recovery goal for the black bear in Alabama? Is there a finish line somewhere that y'all say, yeah, this is good, we've, you know, avoided a bottleneck here or increased populations there? Is there anything you're looking at through the state that says this is a recovered population?
Not at this time. We're looking towards healthy populations. At the current time, we have been working with Auburn University for many years. We have several bears. They're working right now in Mobile and Washington counties and Southwest Alabama and Northeast Alabama, collaring bears to get better information on habitat utilization, and also working on a better way to estimate the number of bears that we have in the state, so we can better estimate what we would need to control populations or maintain populations at a suitable level, that we have a robust and healthy bear population, but we also have not a high degree of negative interactions with humans, being, you know, getting in neighborhoods, getting in trash, and causing problems in, you know, in metropolitan areas. So it's a fine line that we're trying to attain, but we'll get there, but we don't have the population to set any kind of seeds for those bears at this time.
All right, so I've blown by all the news breaks here, so I'm just going to wrap it up quickly and ask you one more question, and then have you back on the show to talk about a bunch more subjects. But a big deal last year with the introduction of those special opportunity areas. I heard some great stories from there. How's it worked this year? I mean, when do we – do you have the deadlines been posted? We know when we need to register for those, and explain to folks that didn't hear about the SOAs last year. What are they?
Okay, these SOAs are sort of we call it special opportunity because it is that. It's a limited quota process, similar to what the alligator hunt is, and we have these smaller acquisitions that we've teamed up with the Forever Wild program to acquire these lands, and we break these tracts up into probably 300 to 500 acre tracts, and people go on to our website, www.outdooralabama.com, registered for this SOA hunt, that we have on these various areas. We have 6 areas now under the SOA program, but people will be able to draw and they'll attain a 2 to 4 day hunt with them and a companion to hunt with. They can hunt with them on that track for either a 2 to 4 day period. We also have one geared toward waterfowl up in North Alabama in Jackson County. But it's you'll get a dedicated 3 to 4 day span on that dedicated 300 to 500 acre parcel that's just you and your partner that'll hunt for that, that permit duration.
Wow.
And it's, you know, it's not crowded. It's far less pressure than what you would see on a private hunting club. So it's a, it is in fact a special opportunity. And these areas, we have 2 areas. We'll have one called Portland Landing, which many of you might be familiar with that area in Dallas County that used to be under private ownership that we own in state ownership now. That's one of our special opportunity areas. Cedar Creek is also in Dallas County. We have Oochie Creek in Russell County and Fred T. Stimson down there in Clark County. And Upper State, which we opened this year, which is also in Clark County. And the one in Jackson County that is the waterfowl area is Crow Creek. So it's really a neat program, and it's you know, it's a lofty goal for somebody to get one of these areas. We've had really good reviews on these things, and look to expand that program down the road and try to provide more opportunity like that.
I tell you what, I mean, all those areas that, you know, we had talked about last year are great. And if y'all, if you're listening to what Keith Golden just said, Portland Landing, if you remember some of the maybe 90s, 80s or 90s, some of the best outdoors bow hunting videos, and a lot of video was filmed at Portland Landing. That place is a showstopper.
Oh, it's historic, and we're maintaining the old Portland Landing sign in the same format that it was back then. So it's going to be a, you know, historic, and you know the potential of deer producing area that is. It's a really nice area. In that Dallas County with that chalk soil, it's going to be really outstanding.
All right, y'all go check that out online, and Keith, we'll have to get you back on the show very soon.
Oh, the registration dates. It'll be mid-July through mid-August. So just start looking on our website for those dates. I think it's July 16th through middle of August. I can't remember the date exactly. Sort of caught me off guard on that.
Well, why don't we do this? Then that way you need to come back on the show here before we open up the dates for the SOAs. See what I'm talking
about? That's a great idea, Sean.
There we go. I'm full of something every once in a while. Sometimes it's a good idea. Keith Golden, thank you for your time.
You bet, Sean. Anytime.
All right. Keith Golden, of course, Wildlife Section Chief with Alabama Department of Wildlife and Freshwater Fisheries. So, yeah, gator season coming up in August. That registration going on right now. We'll talk about that for the next couple of weeks. And then those SOAs. What a story. And what a new opportunity for hunters right here in the state of Alabama. Coming right back. We'll wrap it up here on FM Talk 106.5 Outdoors. All right, big thank you to Keith Golden with the Department of Conservation Natural Resources, Wildlife and Freshwater Fisheries Division. We'll get him back on the show very soon. Talk more about those special opportunity areas. Big thanks to Blake Michaleski. And it's time for us to get out of here. This is time we make for Prep Sports Report. They're on next. By the way, podcast should post up later this hour. You want to share the show? Please do. Check us out online, fmtalk1065.com. Click the link for podcasts.